You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services estimates 1 in 8 Americans is over the age of 65, a proportion that's expected to reach 1 in 5, that's 20%, by the year 2030. In Tennessee, the percentage of senior citizens is even higher. Right now, it's about 1 in 6. Existing social safety nets were created in times when Americans had shorter lifespans and different needs in their golden years. Today's demands for senior citizens and their caregivers represent in some ways a fundamental shift in how we think about quality of life, medical care, and social connection in our older years. Today on Dialogue, elder care and its unique challenges. Joining me today in the studio are Dr. Karen Rose of the University of Tennessee College of Nursing. She specializes in care for older adults. Dr. Rose, welcome.
Thank you.
And Edward Harper. He's a licensed clinical social worker who oversees senior services for Blount Memorial Hospital. Ed, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
As we were talking about before we got on the air, this is a complicated realm, to say the least. This is not like, you know, going to a walk-in clinic when you're feeling kind of under the weather and you pop into the Walgreens. Elder care is a different thing entirely. The numbers that I gave help us understand the scope of the population that may be in direct need of elder care. As we talk about Americans 65 and older, but not the overall group that may come into contact with the questions and issues involved. That could be a much larger proportion of Tennessee's population. Why don't we talk about some of the people who are affected by elder care? Who are the stakeholders, the people who might be involved in that? And maybe we could start with you, Dr. Rose. Who are the people who are involved in elder care?
Sure. So thank you for the question. Many, many people are involved in providing care for our older adults. The statistics I'm aware of are that for every one older adult who's being taken care of at home, typically 4 or 5 other persons are really helping them, either directly with such activities as bathing, feeding, that kind of thing, or indirectly through IADLs, instrumental activities of daily living. And these are things like helping them shop, driving them to appointments, those kinds of things. So if you think of the numbers that you gave and then multiply that by 4 or 5, that's really a tremendous, there's a saying that if you are not yet a caregiver, you will be, or you have been, that this is really something that touches really every facet of our population. So it's not just older adults, it's their family members, it's grandchildren, and we are in the midst of a sandwich generation. Increasingly, family members are still working full time, maybe taking care of children who are still at home and taking care of older adult parents and grandparents. So, again, that notion that if you have not yet been a caregiver, you will be. You will be involved with this.
And Ed, of course, you're the interface for a lot of folks who have these questions and are starting to wrestle with these issues. Is that pretty much your experience as well?
Exactly, Brandon. I would add some years and dates on that. If you are a woman between the ages of 47 and 65, chances are that you are facing a dilemma in caregiving, whether to keep your job, leave your job, take a promotion, take a promotion, take time off, use sick days because of cell phones, break that cardinal rule at work of taking personal calls because you're every 15 minutes. And I want to go with what Dr. Rose says, is that this is a multi-generational, and to use those metaphors, the tsunami, the gray tsunami coming out of the 80s with the books that came in, all of that, and then the sandwich generation, which I've been hearing for 20 years, I think we're more like a hoagie right now.
Yeah, we're much larger than a sandwich. Yeah.
Yes, and speaking to this question, the caregivers, we have 4 generations of caregivers. And of course, when we're looking at that statistical generation, it's between 47 and 65. Mm-hmm. Right at 90% of those people are female, taken care of. Not that some of us males are not doing that too, but statistically it's there. And then you have your spousal caregivers, because that lady was probably taking care of even a mother-in-law because of just the gender culture we have. And we go from people who are spousal caregivers, but you don't even count that, right? Because it's called marriage or partnerships.
Yeah.
It is sort of a hidden fact. I do want to play one more on what Karen said is with Rosalynn Carter. I quote her frequently. She has the Rosalynn Carter Institute for Caregiving at Georgia Southwestern University. And she has a quote that says there's four types of people in the world. I'm sure you know this, Karen. Mm-hmm. Those who have given care, who are giving care, those who will give care, and if you live long enough, and the toughest place to be, those who will receive care.
Yeah. Well, Karen, I want to turn back to you for a moment to go back to your specialty in studying some of the needs and unique demands of this population. What are the unique needs that help define elder care as opposed to any other form of medical or personal care? I noticed you dropped an acronym in IADLs. These are maybe letters that not all of us understand. Mm-hmm. So how do we define the needs of elder care and I guess some of the landscape there?
Sure. So I believe that for older adults, some of the notions, we are aware of geriatric syndromes. And those are syndromes that occur more frequently in older adults. And we describe those as an increased risk for falling. Mm-hmm. And certainly that then in and of itself, a fall really does can begin then a whole cascading downward of untoward effects. Oftentimes, a fall really is a predictor then of mortality. So the notion of falls is something that really is unique in the older adult population as a syndrome. Delirium, and as we know, as we get older, our body functions differently. So new medications we may metabolize very differently. They stay in the system longer, and they may have an untoward effect. And so this notion of delirium comes into play. Certainly dementia comes into play as well. Depression, we call them the 3 Ds, delirium, dementia, depression. Those come into play. Other possible geriatric symptoms, urinary incontinence. Incontinence in and of itself can be a real predictor of needing to go to a higher level of care. It can be very physically demanding, certainly socially isolating, incredibly expensive. These geriatric syndromes, I would say, are really some of the way medically and from a nursing perspective that we help give parameters around older adults and some of the unique needs that they may have.
Ed, I wanted to ask you, since you've been a caregiver for a long time and you work with caregivers, again, you're sort of a nexus point for a lot of the people involved. How has our idea of elder care changed in the time that you've been involved in these services? I mean, are we asking the same set of basic questions, same concerns as we would have 35, 40 years ago, or are we looking at it differently today?
I look at it different. I'm 65.
So
70 is not too far away.
Right.
And I'm not sure I'm an elder, but when I started out, that was the term. So I guess we've got a whole generation of folks saying, I'm not that old yet. Mm-hmm. So you've asked an extremely important question. What was happening in the 70s, which was 40-something years ago,
right.
The 80s being 30-something years ago, we started that rise in the generation, you know, aging, and proverbially we've said people live longer because we've got better medicines, and that has actually happened. Mm-hmm. The longevity, life expectancy is up. So we are now dealing with greater numbers of people. We also had a decline in birth rates. We have a decline in birth rates now. We had one up with the baby boomers. We took care of a lot of folks, but when we hit our 30s and 40s. So we just to kind of touch on the age demographics there, mm-hmm. those people who were giving care are now receiving care or giving that spousal care with that four designation dynamic. The other thing is that we have industry that's building around that in terms of housing, mm-hmm. Care. I am now seeing a return to nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and even doctors making house calls. So that just faded away.
Years ago. Sounds unusual to me that would be coming back. Yeah.
But when we look at the dynamics of can your patient come to you?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
Or can that person take off work to get a patient to a clinic and wait? And perhaps there's delirium involved or dementia. Can that person actually wait in a clinic waiting room?
So a market seems to have developed for some of these services.
Markets are developing around that, the access to care, medical care, as I'm sure Dr. Rose is seeing. We're also seeing in housing, you've probably seen a lot of difference in from going from the home, the nursing home, and the word put. I grew up with the word put someone away, no, we don't do that. We work diligently to find a place that is safe enough, good enough, clean, well-lighted, that people can live. And then it comes down to the issues of finance around that. There are presenters in Knoxville that do programs, and one of them is called Money Buys Medicine. Well, it does. Money buys care, buys medicine, and it's how much that you have. And there's been product lines. I know I'm taking a lot of time here. So there's been product lines developed around long-term care that have changed extensively since the 80s. You can't buy the same long-term care policy that you could in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. They don't exist just because of the financial landscape. That's not criticism. That's just market. And then you've got transportation that's coming about. You see a lot more people making non-medical transports for folks. There's that transport. There's also, which I'm very proud of, and in Knoxville you have it also, volunteer drivers. In Blount County we have Senior Miles, Smiles, which there is a very low cost to be in the membership program. And for those people who can't drive, their volunteer drivers would come out. So we've got a total landscape, Brandon, and I'm not going to dominate the conversation with the extent of that. But you know, when you start talking about how things have changed, it's that we're looking at it weekly.
Yeah, it seems like it for sure. And I guess this would be continuing as we continue to see baby boomers age and our parents' generations and maybe as this market continues, as I said earlier, to grow as we see a larger segment of our population in need of it.
Well, let's tell the truth here. It's not just baby boomers. Yeah, I mean, yes, it is, but we still have folks, statistically, the most populated growth demographic we've got is 90 and up and 100.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And then when we're talking about baby boomers, yes, there are 10,000 people, Americans turning 65 every day, but we have the Generation X. They've already turned 50.
That's right, yeah.
Right. Now, dementia doesn't care what age you are. You know, a condition that causes dementia doesn't care what age you are. That can start at age 50, 55. So now we've got folks in Generation X being spousal partner caregivers. I just wanted to open that one up. So when we look at caregiving, adult caregiving, yes, it is elder care. However, the landscape is vast.
Let me add to that as well in terms of the changing demographics. So you're absolutely correct. Those 85, 90 and above are the fastest growing demographic of our population. But what's interesting as well is that it's minority populations in those age areas, and that really is going to change the landscape of the kind of care that we deliver, who delivers that care, and what the preferences are. It's the Hispanic older adults, and African American population really is older population really is growing. And are we prepared for that? Do we have we trained up for that? Do we have enough healthcare professionals who are trained and culturally competent and to deal with the nuances and the preferences of those other of those minority populations, which aren't going to be minority for long. So it's an exciting time as well. I think a real challenging time if you're a healthcare provider.
All right. We're going to pause now for a station break. We're going to open up the phone lines when we come back. We also want to solicit your questions on Twitter at WUOTFM. Tweet us. You can also send us a message on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WUOTFM. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue continues from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. If you're just joining us, our topic today is elder care in Tennessee. Our guests are Dr. Karen Rose of the UT College of Nursing and Edward Harper, who oversees senior services at Blount Memorial Hospital. As we continue along with our discussion, we want to open up the phone lines as well. The number is 974-5050. You can also tweet us at WUOTFM or send us a message on Facebook. What varieties of elder care exist, right? So we know there's live-in caregivers or visit-in caregivers. There's home, not at home. There are all kinds of ways of looking at this particular issue that can adapt to different needs, geography, culture, family. We talked about that just a moment ago. So what are the varieties, and this could be for either of you, what are the varieties of elder care that we have available?
You're speaking about services. Mm-hmm. You have the traditional, those people who are doing the good deeds out there come help you, good neighbors. Mm-hmm. Communities pony up for with programs for seniors, the senior centers. And then when you're getting to more of what you're speaking about, Brandon, is you're looking at who would I pay to come in?
Yeah.
Okay. There are businesses and there are agencies, private nonprofits, that have in-home non-medical caregivers. And those rates, I won't say on air, but they go up quite a bit, and they've gone up quite a bit since I've been in this line of service. So you want to make sure when you're looking at those businesses that you compare rates. You are starting to do a business deal, a mm-hmm. business deal of care. So we have to kind of look at that. Yes, care comes from a heart and compassion, and as I said, the presenters in Knoxville that talk about money buys medicine, it's a true thing, where money buys care. So we're looking at how much we spend, how long we spend it, and what levels we spend it on. So you have the in-home non-medical that come in and do some of the chores, sort of the instrumental things. They don't do the executive pieces of it. Families do that. Then you have assisted livings. You have retirement resorts, which are different than assisted living, which have concierge service that mimics assisted living. But Brandon, may I just tweak this just a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
As a caregiver, to provide any of this service, it is essential that the caregivers have power of attorney. Medical power of attorney and financial power of attorney. There are plenty of attorneys out there that can advise you on this. There are free attorneys for legal assistance, and I'm sure UT has a program and we like that. But the message is powers of attorney are not old people documents. If you're 18 years of age, so everybody listening to this, if you're 18 years of age, pay attention. You need someone who is an authorized representative, at least for your health care.
A powerful message for any of us.
Any of us.
Yeah.
But when we look at trying to get powers of attorney for older adults, it's seen as, are you trying to get in my business? Are you trying to take control of my life? Mm. But if we look at this, that what we're doing is just designating somebody in the world that can pursue these services that we're starting to allude to, because we go from in-home non-medical to assisted living if affordable, and then at the points that you need skilled nursing for that, then that becomes either affordable, inaffordable, or that you go on Medicaid. But for anybody to negotiate all of this, we're talking about, as you said, somebody in delirium, not dementia, and Dr. May just described part of that, but they're no longer able to make executive decisions on their own, either temporarily or has progressed to the point they can't. So if you were my power attorney, Brandon, then you could make those decisions at the time that I could no longer speak for myself. So I'm not going to go into much more about that. But that is the essential element of securing any service.
We have a related question, actually. Barbara in Knoxville, you're on the line. Go ahead with your question on dialogue.
Yes, thank you for the presentation. I was wondering how delirium manifests itself or presents.
Okay, what are we looking for in those situations, Dr. Rose?
So that's a great question, and thank you. Really, the telltale sign of delirium is acute confusion. And it's typically manifested in a variety when older adults maybe are hospitalized, when they're in unfamiliar environments, when they have an acute infection, oftentimes a urinary tract infection, quite frankly, people become delirious. When they are introduced to new medications, that can cause delirious. A delirium episode. And what we know too is that once a person is hospitalized, they may go home and this delirium may continue for days and weeks. So it's really something that family members need to be aware of and need to be monitoring and need to be in touch with their healthcare providers about. It can be a very dangerous situation. What the state of the science is right now in terms of really dealing with delirium is less and less are we trying to medicate for that. We understand that we're exacerbating the delirium by trying to medicate and sedate, that we're trying other non-pharmacologic means of trying to reorient the person and really figure out what the underlying cause is.
Yeah.
But that's a great question. Thank you.
I see the same thing. Delirium is not dementia. And you can have delirium with dementia, which will exacerbate that. It'll make the dementia look worse. Delirium is caused by an outside agent of some sort, an infection, illness, pain, medications that don't suit the person. And when I say medications, not just the prescribed medications, Brandon, but the over-the-counter, behind-the-counter supplements that don't work. Also, certain medications will cause that. Well, you would think, well, I've been taking this for 10 years. And why is this happening now?
Hmm.
Diet, sleep patterns, stress. There's so many as an outside, but as Dr. Rose is speaking, is that, yes, we see delirium, but it's an acute. It's something that has happened very fast. And dementia is a slower. Dementia is a symptom of a condition that happens at a slower rate. Delirium is a symptom of a condition that happens very acutely.
Oh, okay. That's an interesting distinction, too. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much, Barbara, for that question. I'd like to go now to Betty in Knoxville. We will not go to Betty. Sorry about that. That's all right. I will jump down on my list of questions here, because if we talk about the options that are available, as we mentioned, not all of them require you to go to an assisted living facility or to a nursing home. I mean, it could be live-in care. It could be something, or it could be something really simple. So the type of care that may be offered or may be relevant to a person may morph as they change and as they grow older, from a starting point to an end point. Could you talk a little bit, perhaps, Ed, about that evolution, and that just, okay, well, we got it all taken care of, everything's fine now, because 2 years from now, 3 years from now, that may not be the case.
Yes. If it all went perfectly according to some grand scheme, it would be family members took care of the person in the stages that they began to see some executive failing or impairment there, or mild cognitive impairment, and then said, okay, let's bring someone in to be our eyes and ears and sort of a safety person in home non-medical care. Or if that person had to go for hospitalization and rehabilitation, they would be discharged with home health, which is not in home non-medical care. Home health is specific duties for specific conditions and treatments, and is shorter lived. Of course, in-home non-medical care is out-of-pocket care for the most part. There are some, and I'm not going to go into the programs there, but there are some programs that would pay. And then let's say, well, we got to the point that maybe you could go to an adult day activities enrichment center, okay, that's a little more affordable. Or then the transition would be to assisted living or to a home for the age, which we used to call boarding homes, which are still certified and I think and licensed through the state of Tennessee, but they're homes for the aged. They're not the assisted living, but they're that kind of in between, more like the independent. Or they might perhaps be, as some folks are using, the retirement resort. There's several here, very fine ones in Knoxville area and East Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, if it is a memory loss, if it is a dementia-causing care rather than maybe a Parkinson's or a stroke, stroke may never go to dementia, but you may need physical care.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go to that nursing home. You know, it's what we call, it's sort of that dreaded, well, we don't want to go there. Who wants to go there? No one, but there are some very fine facilities that are doing a lot to make longer-term nursing care not maybe palatable, but it makes it livable. They do a great job with end of life. And then, of course, hospice, which in my experience twice has just been a godsend to our family and somebody helping negotiate the final days of life with comfort. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, not to get too personal, but it sounds like you have it. Then not only are you somebody who helps link people up and answer questions when they're thinking about elder care, it looks like you've been on the receiving end of it as well as somebody who's involved in those processes. Does that help inform how you then advise people?
It really changes my worldview on it. Yes, I'm much more of a practical person, and I really appreciate academics, and I like to live there too. I attended a lecture years ago that said where the rubber meets the sky and where the rubber meets the road. And I tend to be where the rubber meets the road. So when, Brandon, when I work with folks, I've got three missions. One, for a caregiver, just to be heard, not to be counseled so much, but just to be able to tell their story, the story of the day, the story of experience, just to be heard. And then the second thing is look at two pieces of strategy, what now and what next. Because caregivers can't do one thing for doing five. They're just overwhelmed. And then look at the possible resources. That's what you're alluding to. What's out there? What are the resources that might help?
Yeah.
But we never can tell, Brandon, if you hired somebody to come in and take care of me, and you did a great thing, and you spent a lot of time doing that, and you brought an in-home non-medical person in, and then I said, I don't want anybody in my house. Get out of here. And then I gave them a hard time and run them away. You know, that's where the caregiver frustration is, and I think I'll defer to Doc on this one.
We could all easily talk about the ripple effects of elder care on people who are not receiving it, but the ones who are giving it or who are managing it. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So I'd first like to say that there are, you know, two sides to this coin. Certainly there are incredibly positive and rewarding aspects to being a family caregiver. To giving back and feeling a sense of pride in that is pretty incredible. And you don't hear as much about that. And so that's why I wanted to highlight that first. I do believe, though, too, what you hear more about are some of the caregiver burden and strain that caregivers feel over time. What we do know is that that's true, that's real, and that caregivers typically, there was a landmark study done in 1999, and that was the one that really showed that family caregivers, when you take into account other aspects, age, other comorbidity, other disease processes, that sort of thing, that they do have a higher rate of mortality. They do die faster. So that's something that I think made us all in the field kind of take a step back and go, whoa, this is real, and what can we do to really try to mitigate that? We do know that family caregivers oftentimes, because of the strain of taking care of a loved one, which, by the way, might not always be a loved one, in terms of there are always dynamics there. And so there can be incredible strain when the dynamic is not as positive as we as
and
one.
And here we might be talking about maybe kids who didn't get along with mom and dad.
Absolutely.
And now you're put in the position of having to do intensive care for
absolutely.
Them.
Yeah. And maybe give up your employment, give up your time, your energy, your financial resources, and you're not feeling very positive about that. So that's a whole different avenue. But what we do know about caregivers, they oftentimes neglect their own physical health. They are less likely to go for preventive screening services, more likely to miss appointments. We know they have higher rates of depression and anxiety. We know that they can have immunological consequences. They don't often respond as well to things like flu vaccines. So there's really a very physiological process going on to this notion of caregiver strain.
The question that we had from Betty, she wanted to be off air. She didn't want to join us. That's why I had to do a quick step on that one. But she submitted a question. She took care of her husband until he passed. He was a veteran. They sought care at the VA with mixed results. So her question was, what resources are there for older caregivers in a similar situation? And there we might be talking about spouses or even siblings who are taking care of somebody in their age bracket.
Okay, since you mentioned the word veteran, first of all, make sure you're contacting your Office for Veterans in your county. Then there's a state veterans program. And there's a program that somewhat gets not as much airplay. It's called Aid in Attendance. And that is care for a veteran with certain eligibility requirements in that, and also care for the spouse. So that's one that gives some financial reimbursement or some financial funds, financial funds for home care or assisted living care, and it's called Aid in Attendance. So I'll just say that on air, and then folks check it out with their Office on Aging and also their veterans officers in their county. The one of the studies that you were talking about in terms of caregiver stress, there's one is probably just a little bit older, but it comes from the College of Nursing, and I always trust nurses.
Okay. I know I do.
I know I do.
I work with Dr. Carol Myers, and she taught me that early on.
Yes, yes. And it's from the University of Chicago, and it outlines caregiver stress from the first few months all the way up to about 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it's been a longitudinal study that I've used in my presentations. And it also, the caregiver stress, it hits parts of our brain that we just don't think about because it's not the thinking part of our brain. So I have a presentation, it's called The Emotional Complexities of Giving Care, which acknowledges the good things in it.
Absolutely.
But also says, well, what's happening at a subcortical level? What's happening below the gray matter? What's happening with the thalamus, the hypothalamus, and your amygdala, your fear and flight? Endocrinology. I'm not a doctor, I'm not an MD, but I do hang out with a lot of educated people.
There you go. You pick up a little something along the way. We're going to pause for another station break. We'll have the final third of dialogue in just a few moments. Again, if you want to reach us on Twitter, it's at WUOTFM. Send us a message on Facebook, or you can call us at 974-5050. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue now continues. Our topic today, elder care in Tennessee. Cynthia, you've been on the line with us, hanging out patiently. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, I'm calling about long-term care insurance. How can it be used? Any advice you all can offer on who should get it, how it can be used, and just any advice in that area.
All right, thanks.
Well, that's a commercial question, and thank you very much. I really can't answer that to the depth that your question extends. What I can say that it has changed over the years, and when you're talking to about an existing policy, you want to make sure that you have power of attorney so you can actually talk to the people about this in an in-depth level and examine that policy as to what areas of care it actually covers, because some were written to cover only nursing, skilled nursing service, some for only assisted living, and some for only in-home non-medical care. So some of them, of course, most of them are going to cover that landscape in there, but make sure you've got, you've reviewed that policy and with an agency or a broker, not an agency, but an agent or a broker that is credible for doing that. Because the product lines have changed so much since 2008, when we had our last recession, mm-hmm. And folks in all aspects of finance took a beating on things, and the market shifted. It's interesting. It would be interesting to look and see where these product lines are going. So again, I would say check out with a registered agent, a nationally recognized product, and there's several brokers that are very reputable in our area for consultation. So I guess being not able to answer that in depth, because you have asked a very extensive question, is that how do we plan for longer term care? So part of that is going to be an insurance policy. Some of it be your own savings, some of it be assets, and some of it we were talking with financial advisors and elder law attorneys about what to do with what assets you have. So let me end that there. Okay.
Well, Cynthia, thank you so much for the question. We do appreciate it. This actually gets to an area that I wanted to explore anyway. As we talked about before we came on the air, I am in my early 30s, cresting mid-30s now. So these may be questions that I'm not thinking about today, but might be, you know, before my time is up, I'll be probably wrestling with some of these questions. I have family out of state. I live here. They're somewhere else. When we start to ask these kinds of questions, where do we know where to begin? How do I know what's my first question? It's like, I guess, how do you know the unknown so that you know you're getting good information, a good starting point for the needs for that family member or that relative who may need care?
That's a great question. So I know what we're advocating for increasingly, and there's a national movement, to have this conversation at Thanksgiving. While you're giving thanks, have a conversation with your parents, with your family members about what are their wishes, you know, and just begin the conversation. I don't think it's a one and done. I think it's a continued...
It doesn't sound like, I mean, just based on what I've heard from the two of you today, this is a multi-layered, multi-factored issue to deal with.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are resources, certainly online and through the Senior Services Directory that the Knox County Office on Aging offers, too. There are resources abounding to help people with it start the conversation, because people oftentimes will say, I don't know what to say to my mom. You know, I don't know how to start the conversation.
Right,
there's
right.
Absolutely, there are ways, kind of tricks of the trade for how to start the conversation. And if you know that it's, you want to do it before you need to do it, and so being very proactive about that, I think is really important. You don't want to have this level of conversation in the midst of a crisis. This is a conversation you want to have when people are calm, when people are, you know, kind of cool and collected. And
when the decision doesn't have to be made tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When
it's
you're
like,
not
we
in
need
a crisis
an answer right this
today
second.
Because we need to get help tomorrow or yesterday.
Gosh.
So I think that's the first thing, just realizing that this is a conversation that needs to be had kind of often, early and often, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I want to build off Cynthia's question about long-term insurance, just to talk about, again, the multiple options that are available for different people and different needs. Are they covered by insurance or Medicare? Like, what are those kind of questions we need to start considering for how to make it happen in terms of what's covered and what's not?
Okay, usually your aged county has, or most counties have, an office on aging. And within that office, they have somebody that is knowledgeable about Medicare and Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you the very quick on it, is Medicare is taking care of your doctors, your clinics, your hospitalizations, and rehab. Medicaid is your long-term care, and it meets the requirements. Medicare is 65 and up, if you mm-hmm. choose to use that. Medicaid is 65 and up, or with disabilities. There's too many caveats to go in, but just sort of your traditional Medicaid will kick in at 65. If you meet the federal guidelines for poverty, having only about $2,000 to your name at any one moment, or using a trust to make that happen, and then have medical eligibility. So in terms of government programs covering that, that's the two basic ones,
mm-hmm.
and then you have the veterans benefits, and then, I mean, this is a vast thing. So again, starting with your office on aging is a good place. Online information is out there. It's always critical when you're using online information to make sure you're getting something that is credible, not just an advertisement.
I want to jump in for a second and say, I was just Googling while you were talking. The Knox County Office on Aging is online at knoxseniors.org. We're going to have more links, by the way, on our website, wuot.org. If you want to listen to the program later on today, the archived version of this conversation, you'll also find some extras down at the bottom of the page where we're going to put you in touch with state and local resources on answering some of these questions, at least to give you a starting point. So, again, that is one of those where it seems like such a heavy and large issue. It's like, where do you begin to start to untangle that particular knot? Maybe a key question. It may be different for different people and different needs, sounds like.
It is.
What kind of out-of-pocket expenses are we talking about? This sounds fairly pricey.
Well, even if you have long-term care insurance, there usually is an exclusionary period that you're going to pay out-of-pocket 30, 60, 90 days, maybe more, depending on which policy you bought. Also, if you're paying for care is fee for service, when you get beyond what your clinic, your hospitalization insurance pays, it's out of pocket. Assisted living, unless you have long-term care that's going to pay for part of that, is out of pocket. It's a business deal. It's the same thing as staying at a hotel. You're paying at a hotel for accommodations and services. When you go to an assisted living or use that product line, you're paying for accommodations and care. So that is pretty much a business deal. When you get to the nursing home level, or the institutional pieces of that, is that's when Medicaid may kick in. But again, that depends on your financial and your medical eligibilities.
Dr. Rose, I want to turn back to you on this. We covered this a little bit as it specifically applied to delirium, warning signs for that. But as we're thinking about what to watch out for in our relatives whom we may not see all the time, you know, or spouses that we're very used to, or whoever in between, When we start to think about, oh, that's normal, they're fine, versus, I may need to start looking into this more deeply, what would we typically be looking for to think, okay, that plan we came up with, because we did come up with a plan, let's assume the best on that, to start putting that into action?
Sure. So that's a great question, too. And not every time you forget something means that you're headed down the track of dementia.
I hope not, because I have a terrible memory.
Okay, very good.
I'm already there.
So if you look at the Alzheimer's website, you know, they have 10 risk factors or 10 questions to ask yourself. And so I lose my phone almost every day, my cell phone and my keys, and that's not necessarily going to take me down the road of dementia. I think what that is more in our very full lives, we are multitasking, and humans as a species are not good at multitasking. Mm-hmm. So I think some of that is just our lifestyle. But what I would say is anything that strikes you as being different. So if someone who's typically been very active in their community and now is withdrawing from their family and friends, I think that's a warning sign. Someone, if you're seeing balance issues, I'd say to you, that's a warning sign. If you're seeing forgetfulness in terms of major issues, forgetting who their loved ones are, forgetting if they've been lost while they've been driving. Much of driving, as we know, is really quite rote memory, getting to the grocery store and back. But when there's a detour or when there's something different and your loved one reports, oh, they got lost or, you know, something like
on
that.
On what would normally be a very routine kind of
absolutely
assignment.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I would say, too, if you suspect something, don't push it to the background. Many of the causes of these kinds of forgetfulness and these other mood disorders are very treatable if detected early. And we have better treatment options when they are detected early. So I'm a real advocate for if you suspect something, get some help. Go to a healthcare provider and get it checked out, because it could be as easy as a vitamin deficiency. It could be a medication reaction. So I don't think that you necessarily have to be in a panic mode and be thinking, oh my gosh, we're headed down this track of dementia. It's not that at all. So I'm a real advocate for if you see something, do something.
Yeah. As we talk about, we've been spending a lot of this conversation talking about the process and how to go through it if you're the person who's going to be the caregiver or the person who's power of attorney or you've got control of the assets or whatever happens. I want to flip it just a little bit to talk about what this means for the people who are getting the care. And what I'm thinking about is how do you navigate that territory where you might have to say, Dad, you can't drive anymore. That's a hard conversation to have. I've been through it in our family. With some of my older relatives, or I know you want to stay in your house. I know you've owned this house since Truman was in office, and I know this is what you're used to, but we can't let that happen anymore. You're going to get hurt. That's a difficult conversation to have. Maybe, Ed, you could give us some advice on to be sensitive to what this person must be going through about the confusion, about their scare. They're like, wait, you're taking me where? Or this is going to happen. There's going to be somebody living in my house. How do you manage that conversation with sensitivity to them?
I applaud you for handling that, because when we talk about those independent skills that make us driving, yeah. Having a place of your own, their safety is the key deciding point. Trying to keep things the same, trying to honor folks.
Because I feel like that happens too, where it's like, oh gosh, I can't do that. That would be so painful. Or, oh, we can't do this to Mom. You know, there's got to be a two way on that where it's hard for both.
Oh, really? It is. And when we cut down to it, it's safety. You answer the question on safety. Is it safe for someone to drive? Yes or no? Well, it'd be nice if we could just make that determination, but we can't, because that is a contract between the licensing state and that person with a license. We might be able to try to get them to change their mind, but in living in homes when they're not safe, at some time a house becomes no longer an asset, it becomes a liability
with
upkeep, and that's when you make decisions based on safety and security for that person, and also safety and security for the caregiver. Is it safe for me to drive 8-16 hours once a month to go see people, or twice a month? Is it safe for me to continue to take days off? Is this safe for me? It's not basically going to bleed out safe, that kind of thing, but is it emotionally safe? Is it financially safe? So, Brandon, I guess just to kind of answer that very complicated question is that we have to put safety and security over honor and dignity and sameness in a family. And that's where dementia rules the family, absurdity, but out of an honoring state, really.
Yeah. So I can see how that definitely would happen. And again, conversations that we've had in my family, maybe many of you who are listening right now, who have had to go kind of through that same issue.
And I find it, you know, you're in your mid-30s. You're starting that. So the caregiving, I want to make sure this gets out. Millennials are starting to give care.
Yeah.
Not just the 65, taking care of the 65 and up, mm-hmm. but we've got people in their 30s making sure there's time.
Well, so for people, what are some of the questions I would need to ask or factors I need to keep in mind if I am interviewing a caregiver, if I'm evaluating an assisted living facility, if I'm, you know, as I'm thinking about that to make sure I'm getting my money's worth, but also that care that we are looking for? Dr. Rose, what are we looking for?
Well, I think first and foremost, know what you're looking for. What are the wishes your family member with whom you're looking to assist in that way? What are their wishes and what are their preferences? What is the wishes of the family certainly as well? And I would echo what Ed has said, that oftentimes when you go to these facilities, who you're met with is a marketing person. And while that's not a bad thing, I think you need to, that's a first layer. You need to look beyond that too. Really, what are the services and do they align with what your family member's preferences are? Then I think that the following thing is certainly it's a financial consideration. There's no question. What can you afford? And it seems harsh to say that, but that's the reality of where we are and the state of affairs here. So it really is, do you need the bells and whistles? Maybe, maybe not. Can you afford them? Maybe, maybe not. So I think those are real questions to ask. What are the staffing ratios? What kind of nutritional services do they offer? Do they offer other therapies, physical therapy, occupational therapy, certainly recreational therapy? I mean, it's incredibly important for our older adults to remain socially engaged and to have a purpose. And what are some of the outlets that they have for people beyond bingo? I know there's a great article that just talks about beyond bingo, and there's much more to living out your golden years than bingo.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So then that means that families and caregivers should feel empowered to go beyond the brochure, as it were, and ask for data or ask for more information or ask to talk maybe to somebody else who works there. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. And to the extent that you can talk with other family members who are receiving care there. What do they like? What mm-hmm. don't they like?
Yeah.
It's not that people are very forthcoming with that.
Yeah,
I can imagine. Yeah,
and then some just general statistics out. And around 2006 and 8, we have a lot of other nations seeing that there was a growth here. So they invested heavily in the older living industries here. So there may be, or any. We have a global society. So not everybody investing in an American-sounding name is from this country. So I'm not putting something out political, but it's just that we have lots of different folks in a business, in an industry. And you have to remember that going into some of these is a business deal, and they're negotiable. So.
Okay. Well, any final thoughts are coming up on the end of our hour together, something that we didn't cover that you think is really important that we need to get out there?
First of all, thank you for having this conversation.
Absolutely.
It's extremely important. And as you say, there's lots of layers and lots of players and that type of thing. The other is that for all those people giving care out there, thank you.
Absolutely. I would say, too, that for all those giving care or for all those who in the future will be giving care, you're not alone. And although it may feel like that, you're not. So reach out to local community-based organizations. They have a myriad of supportive services.
And again, we're going to be adding to that list of links at our website, wuot.org. So if you're looking for kind of a one-stop, at least a starting point, we'll try to give you one online later on this afternoon. Ed Harper of Blount Memorial Hospital, licensed clinical social worker, thank you so much for your time today. Dr. Karen Rose of the UT College of Nursing, thank you to you as well. And everybody who called in with great questions today. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. You've been listening to Dialogue, which is a production of WUOT News. Greg Hill is our producer. I'll see you again this afternoon on All Things Considered at 4:00.